Thank you, Professor Mandal, for your nice introduction. At the outset, I am thankful to the organizer of AES Colloquium, particularly to Dr. Swetanagan. He has made several communications to me for this lecture. So, very good afternoon to all of you, and a goodwill message from my university, University of Kalyani, which is situated in the district of Nadia. It is the native home district of Professor Mandal. So, today's talk, Changing Pattern of Insecticide Use and its Impact on Environment and Biodiversity, an Evaluation in Indian Perspective. This changing insecticide use pattern is practically related with the changing cropping pattern, and this in turn is associated with the change in biodiversity and environment. This is a global issue, but we have impacts in India also. So in the next few slides, I shall be talking about its impacts on the world as a whole, as well as to Indian environment and Indian biodiversity. In fact, the changing cropping pattern was felt necessary long ago, during 1940s or sometime during that period, when there was an urge to fight against the hunger. Millions of peoples were starved, particularly in Africa, and there was a necessity to develop something to increase the production to fight against this hunger. And there was an initiative from some quarters, and this initiative became successful only because of the fact that at the same time there was a development in genetics and plant breeding, there was development in engineering and tools, all together contributed to this fight against hunger. And that resulted in the development of an institute with the help of Rockefeller and Ford Foundations, which is known as the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, CIMMYT, which is the abbreviated form of the Spanish name of this institute, and this is the beginning of the Green Revolution. This was an autonomous international research institute, and Dr. Norman Borlaug, who actually hailed from Texas A&M University, he was made the director of its International Wheat Improvement Program. He is actually now today considered as the father of Green Revolution. So he took 20 years to develop a high-yielding variety of wheat. A tireless research, he took several experiments, and finally, as a result of crossbreeds, he was able to develop high-yielding variety, or HYV, a disease-resistant dwarf variety of wheat. Finally, maize, rice also were developed. So that is a 20-year story. But this development took place in Mexico, and Mexico was the cradle of Green Revolution. But the success was possible only when this technology was transferred to Asia. First in the Philippines, where the International Rice Research Institute was developed with the help of the same foundations, and finally this technology was transferred to India, Bangladesh, China and other Asian countries. If it was not experimented in these countries, probably this success of Green Revolution could not be felt. And in fact, this, as a result of this just a minute. Sorry. Okay. As a result of this green revolution, the production of wheat and rice increased to a great extent. This is the data downloaded from World Health Organization, World Food and Agriculture Organization, and these are some of the recent data, and these are some of the states in which this green revolution technology was implemented, and the final result was that there was a bumper crop production. And this was possible only because at that time the Minister of Agriculture was C. Subramaniam, Director General of Indian Council of Agricultural Research was M. S. Swaminathan, and the Agricultural Secretary was Sivaraman, 3S. This 3S was a most influential, and with their help the green revolution technology was acceptable to India. They made several experiments, and finally this green revolution technology was implemented in India. And if they won't help Dr. Norman Borlaug, this green revolution technology perhaps would not be so much popular as it is felt today. And Dr. Norman Borlaug mentioned this in his Nobel lecture. Finally, Government of India also awarded him with Padma Vibhushan in 2006. Dr. Borlaug died in 2009 in his native state, Texas, but still today he is considered as the father of green revolution, and M. S. Swaminathan as the father of green revolution in India. But this green revolution was not restricted to rice and wheat and maize. Today you find this green revolution technology, that means yield of high yielding varieties, it has been propagated to all kinds of vegetables. Today what you find in the market, these are all results of high yielding varieties and the result, final results of green revolution. You see, this is the tomato you find today in the market. There are about 20 high yielding varieties of tomato. You won't find the wild varieties today because the production is 19 kg a plant, 18 tons per hectare, bumper production. This was developed by Indian Institute of Horticultural Research. So many, about 14 varieties of high yielding varieties of brinjals have been produced, and they have, this has been produced by Indian Agricultural Research Institute, Delhi. And each of the variety has been given names such as Anupama, Kranti, Purple Long, etc. So many varieties of cabbage, garlic, beans. So these look very good. If you, if some old peoples are here, if you remember of going to the market 10 years back, you find some ugly looking vegetables. Today won't find such vegetables in the market. These look very good and the production is also very high. Gourd, bitter gourd, cucumber, capsicum, chili, carrot, radish, all are several varieties you find in the market and high production. In the wild there are 135 varieties of seeded banana. But today we find in the market only hardly about 7-8 varieties. You see this cool or bear, what you call in Maharashtra, or so this is a variety is recently I am finding. Sometimes you confuse whether this is a papetra or something like this. It is so big. So you can find several such other vegetables in these commercial varieties of vegetables published by Government of India. So there is no harm in it. So you find this in the market, and but two concerns are there. First, I shall be discussing about the first concern is the loss of biodiversity. When you grow HIV, the farmers are very much interested because they get huge production. So they grow year after year HIV varieties. If the seeds are available, as HIV vegetables are grown by the Indian Institute nowadays, so its seeds are available. If it is produced by the international company like Monsanto, like other things like GMO, it is not GMO, then the availability of seed would have been a problem. Otherwise, this seed availability is no problem. So farmers like to grow this type of HIV vegetables year after year instead of growing the normal wild varieties. As a result, this normal wild varieties are gradually lost. So in the USA, there are about 7,098 varieties of apple. Today, 6,120 types, that means about 80% of it are lost. 88% of the pears, about 3,000 types of pears, it is lost. 95% of the varieties of cabbage, 91% of corn, 94% of the pea, these are all wild varieties, these are lost because the farmers are restricting cultivation only on a few high yielding varieties. Mexico, the cradle of the corn, has now just only 30% of all varieties from 1990. So for the rice and the wheat, on which we actually depend too much, in Asia there are, can you imagine, 1 lakh varieties of wheat. In India, there is about 82,000 varieties, and in West Bengal, in my state, it is about 5,500 varieties. Today, we restrict cultivation only on 10 varieties, high yielding varieties. So what about the other varieties? If these, they are not cultivated, a few days later, you won't find the seeds of these varieties of seeds, rice and wheat. Same situation is Sri Lanka and China also. So as a result of the pressure of high yielding varieties, the wild varieties are not being cultivated. So there is a campaign. This is one aspect of the story. So there is a campaign to revive the wild varieties so that the biodiversity is not lost. It is a big question. What is the harm if these wild varieties are gone and we are culturing on the high yielding varieties? It is a very big question. So some people who are concerned about the ecology, environment and biodiversity, balance of the nature, they prefer that these wild varieties should be preserved. So all over the world there is a movement to preserve these wild varieties and to make the farmers aware of it. So there is a movement of the revival of underutilized species in the form of in situ conservation, restoration and maintenance of agricultural biodiversity through community seed banks. So make a community of 100 or 50 farmers and to make them aware to cultivate some wild varieties. Maybe the production is less. So make a channel in between the farmers. So this has been started in Germany through the biodynamic network of farmers. In India, it has been made popular by Bandana Shiva, a noted environmentalist, in the form of Navdanna movement. This is sponsored by DST. And another fellow, he is also dedicated, he is my contemporary, MSc in Zoology, Dr. Deval Dev. And they are, these few peoples, they are associated with Navdanna movement. And they have so far conserved 5,000 crop varieties, including 3,000 varieties of rice, 95 varieties of wheat, 150 of beans, etc. So this is a great job. This is a great job. Similar kind of movement is also going on in Bangladesh. Farida Alam, this is a lady, and she has started a movement very recently in the same pattern. So main objective is to protect and conserve the wild variety of the seeds. So this is another aspect. One aspect, that is the biodiversity loss. Another aspect, that when you culture high yielding varieties, All high yielding varieties, they need huge input of fertilizers, huge input of water and huge input of pesticides. Obviously, it will have an impact on the environment and there will be environmental degradation. At the same time, when Green Revolution started in 1940 and this Swiss chemist Paul Muller, he discovered the insecticidal property of the DDT. At that time there was a Second World War was going on and the soldiers were dying out of the malaria. There was no treatment, and with the discovery of the insecticidal property of the DDT, the vector of the malaria, that means mosquito, could be controlled, and this was a great achievement. And Paul Muller was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1948. But what happened later, that people thought that this is a miracle to control the insect. As mosquito can be controlled, the insect, other insects also can be controlled. So they started using it in the agricultural field randomly, and as a result the use of DDT became skyrocketed. The harm of DDT was brought to the people by Rachel Carson through his novel Silent Spring. She warned that the DDT can cause cancer. She warned that DDT has a tendency of biomagnification. This is a very important phenomenon. It is shown by not all pollutants, some specific pollutants, they show the tendency of biomagnification. That means if it is present in very small concentration in water, it can be accumulated by small organisms, from small organism to small fish to big fish to birds. As it travels through this food chain, the concentration increases one level after another. And as the concentration increases, this is called a biomagnification, like the amplification through the amplifier of the volume. So here is a phenomenon. If the DDT is an example, if the DDT is present in water at the 0.00003 ppm, it can be biomagnified up to 10 million times in birds. And in fact, the birds, particularly the piscivorous birds, those who eat on the fish, they are the worst sufferer. Moreover, the DDT, it is a non-degradable. It doesn't break down in the environment. So it remains there in the environment for long, long. It is called non-persistent. So that's why the birds are the worst sufferer, but not only the birds, the fish which is consumed by man, man also may become suffer, may suffer, and ultimately it may be a cancerous. So this book, when published, it caused a sensation and there was a struggle. Particularly the DDT producing companies, they were very rich people. They started a campaign against Rachel Carson and wanted to prove that Rachel Carson was a lunatic person. In fact, Rachel Carson died before anything positive step was taken by the government of United States of America. She also died in cancer in 1964. But the voice of people persisted. There was a public pressure on the government of USA, and Environmental Protection Agency was developed in 1970, and DDT was banned in the, this is the year when also Dr. Norman Borlaug was awarded Nobel Prize, and DDT was banned in the US in the 1972 and subsequently in other countries. And Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants 2001 banned most of the organochlorine for the agriculture use. Unfortunately, most of the organochlorine use are still being used in India. This has not yet been banned. DDT has been banned in agricultural use, but DDT is still being licensed for use in home application for control of mosquito. So DDT and organochlorines are banned all over the India, not in all over the world, almost all over the world. But in their place came the organophosphate, carbamates, pyrethroids, mixed formulations. Unfortunately, in India, many organochlorines are still there. And in India, the governing body of the pesticide registration, their license, monitoring, etc., it lies on the Central Insecticide Board and Registration Committee. They register or ban pesticides under the Insecticide Act 1968. Currently, there are about 500 insecticides, pesticides, including 230 insecticides. In India, insecticides are proportionately used more than the other countries as compared to herbicide, rodenticide, fungicide. There are several classes of pesticides. Insecticide is one of them, which is used to kill insects in the agricultural field. So in India, proportionately, insecticides are used more than the other pesticides as compared to the other nations. Another job of the Central Insecticide Board and Registration Committee is to recommend the dose of application in agriculture, or it is called RAD, Recommended Agricultural Dose. So every company which is registered, they have to follow this, they have to make it in their label, and the agriculture and the farmers also have to follow this label. This is one of the data to show you that how insecticide in terms of rupee, how insecticide sell is more than the other group of pesticides. Now, so far as the recommended agricultural dose of insecticides are concerned, now here is a concern for the whole environment. The target in organism is insects, but once the insecticide is used in the agricultural field, it is transferred by absorption, volatilization, spread drip, runoff, or leaching. And 98% of the insecticide that are sprayed in the agricultural fields reach to air, soil, surface water, and groundwater and affect other organisms for which it is not used. These other organisms are called non-target organisms. Who are these? These non-target organisms are plants, honeybees, butterflies, and other pollinators who are used for pollination of flowers, terrestrial vertebrates, soil invertebrates, fish and aquatic invertebrates, and finally, man. In the next few slides, I shall be highlighting some on soil invertebrates and a fish to show you how these non-target organisms are affected by the recommended agricultural dose of different insecticides. The soil is the ultimate reservoir of all kinds of insecticide used in the agricultural fields. And in fact, the soil is the habitat or the house for a diverse kind of organisms, mostly invertebrates. And in this group included are the protozoa, the earthworms, the mollusks, then several kinds of arthropods, and also the mycorrhizae, that means soil root fungi, which are very important to increase the nutrition of the soil. So they not only make a food chain or the balance of the nature below the ground, but also they maintain the soil structure, texture, and the fertility of the soil, natural fertility of the soil. If you put insecticide to kill insects on the plants, and if this insecticide percolate below the ground, and if these organisms are killed, you kill hundreds or thousands of other species to save plant from one species of insect. So a few insecticides used frequently, you see 500 plus pesticides including 230 insecticides have been registered in India currently. So a few representatives from that, and we have did some experiments on this using recommended agricultural dose. As we have done this experiment in the laboratory, we have converted. See, recommended agricultural dose is in the form of active ingredients per hectare, because acre or hectare is the normal unit for agricultural field. So we have, in a normal agricultural field taking 1 foot depth, we have converted this entire area into kg soil, and we have converted this recommended agricultural dose into milligram per kg soil. So 4 groups of insecticide have been considered. Carbamates is a broad chemical category, organochlorine, which have been banned mostly in other countries, not in India, organophosphate, and the most modern group, pyrethroids. And from each category, 2 or 1 insecticide was chosen. And we have did some experiments on earthworm, because earthworms by weight constitute about 92% of the biomass of the soil. This is a biological concentrator also, because earthworms are eaten by the toads. These are eaten by birds. So if any pollutants are accumulated in the earthworms, this will also go into the toads or into the birds or into snakes also. So like that of the biomagnification, as we have seen a few slides earlier, the pollutants, if concentrated in the earthworms, may also go into the other animals. But earthworms has a very natural role in the soil, because they fragment the litter, that means the fallen leaves and other particles on the leaves, decompose it, recycle it, and help in making the soil texture. And they also help in increasing the nitrogen fixing bacteria content in the soil. So they are considered as an ecological engineer in the soil, as a very beneficial organisms. There are about 3000 species, 3000 plus species in the of earthworm in the world. In India there are about 400 plus species, and in India also there are some species which have been brought from other countries for specific purposes. And this slide gives you idea that how many of them are present in agricultural field. This is the data from Haryana. So about 6% of the earthworm species available are present in agricultural field, others present in garden, grassland, wasteland, sewage, etc., etc. So in agricultural fields, you get several varieties of earthworm which are directly exposed to the insecticide application. So to give you an idea, this is a life cycle of earthworm, because earthworm produce cocoon, which takes about 28 days. From cocoon, the juveniles are hatched out. From juveniles, adults emerge. The entire cycle takes about 56 days. So we carried out our experiment on 2 varieties of earthworm. This earthworm is available in the field, normal field, and we used an uncultivated soil where no agricultural application has been done to get the pollution free earthworms. This is another earthworm which is used for making vermicompost, Acina fastidia. This is an exotic species brought from other countries, and this is used for vermicomposting. used both these earthworms for the experiment. And for experiment actually, this type of earthen pot can be used where you put a soil, you put some cow dung as the food of the earthworm, you put some water as the moisture, and this earthworm will produce cocoons. You collect the cocoons and then put it in a environment chamber or BOD chamber. From the cocoon juveniles will get, so you will get the fresh earthworm species for your experiment. So we put this container in an environmental chamber because the temperature, the earthworm is very sensitive to temperature, so that the 28 degree temperature could be maintained and the moisture could be maintained at about 60 to 70% level. We collected the cocoons from this earthen pot, then put it into several such boxes, and each box there was a treatment of one pesticide at different specific concentration. Now you see, this is the susceptibility of the earthworms in comparison to recommended agricultural dose. So the unit was lethal concentration at which 50% of the earthworms was died. This is less than RAD, that means recommended agricultural dose, what is applied in the field. In a dose less than that, 50% of the earthworms was died in carbaryl. So the red indicates these are highly toxic. Both the carbamates were highly toxic. Chlorpyrifos, this is green, that means this is rather safe. At the dose in which it is used in the agricultural field, earthworms are rather safe. In this experiment, we find that recommended agricultural dose for Echina foetida is dangerous for the Echina foetida, but not so dangerous, more or less equivalent to RAD for the other species. Then we reduced the dose, made it 50% or 25%, and carried out long term experiment on the growth of the earthworm. So we made 25% of the LC50 or 50% of the LC50, and out of the 6 insecticides, we selected 3 insecticides which showed some kind of danger. Chlorpyrifos was not dangerous, but still we carried out experiments whether really chlorpyrifos could be dangerous in the long term experiment. So far as the biomass change, that means after certain period, we have seen that this is a control value. There is a continuous growth, but there was a negative growth. Negative growth means some earthworms died, so weight, the cumulative weight was less than what was at the beginning. That's why this is negative. So for chlorpyrifos, it was negative as compared to control, but still it is not totally negative as we find for carbaryl and endosulfan. And this picture is same for both the species, Peryonyx excavatus and Echina foetida, both species of earthworm. So far as the reproduction is concerned, that means cocoon production, hatching success, and number of juveniles produced per 10 individuals, we found that endosulfan is highly toxic because at the 50% LC50 dose there was no cocoon. Even at 25% dose there was no hatching and there was no juveniles. Chlorpyrifos was rather safe, but carbaryl was a intermediate in toxic level so far as endosulfan and chlorpyrifos are concerned. So when we compared with the field data, what happened in the field? These are laboratory experiments. We carried out similar experiments with other parameters. We have seen that our data is at par with the field, and we compared our data with that. This is also this earlier slide was a reproduction parameters on one species. This is another is on another species, same result. So we compared this data with the field data. We have seen that this paper, this shows that in agricultural field there is a gradual reduction of the earthworm numbers, population number, with the amount of insecticide sprayed. So, coming to the conclusion, endosulfan, so far as the growth and reproduction is concerned, it is hampered even at 1% of the recommended agricultural dose. So far as the carvanil is concerned, it is hampered at 20% of the recommended agricultural dose. Chlorpyrifos, it is hampered at the 60%, almost about 60% of the recommended agricultural dose. So this is a neat summary of the total experiment. Now, coming to the fields, what actually happens in there? In fact, we find organochlorine residues, including the endosulfan, in agricultural soils at level which is alarming. We also find the endosulfan and other organochlorine residues in the river sediment. This is a paper representing the river sediment of Jamuna. And in the Koneru lake fish, from this lake fish is supplied all over India. Even in Mumbai market also you find the big fish from Koneru lake. And the different levels of organochlorine concentration is really alarming, really alarming. And there is a paper which shows that this organochlorine residue is responsible for the Parkinson's disease, because in so many Parkinson's disease patients, the organochlorine residues are detected at high concentration. And this is the fact that substantiate one endosulfan, tragic endosulfan episode of Kerala, Kasargod. Here for 24 years the endosulfan was sprayed, aerially sprayed over cashew nut plantation. And over a 4600 area, and it caused a disastrous impact on environment. These figures you find in net easily. There was a big story about this. Last 3-4 years this story is going on all over the end, in Hindu, in Times of India, in NDTV, everywhere this Kasargod endosulfan tragic case. And parliaments, every time there is a debate on this, only because endosulfan, was used as the lone insecticide in the cashew nut plantation. So, one students union, Democratic Youth Federation, they sued against it to the Supreme Court, and ultimately it was banned in Kerala. Kerala government banned it. Thereafter, Supreme Court banned it by an order on which was issued on 30th September 2011. But why endosulfan? You see, this is the picture showing you endosulfan is used. Endosulfan is banned in many countries. Endosulfan is used all over the India because it is a very cheap insecticide. The farmers can easily buy this. However, this has been banned in Kerala. Ultimately, Karnataka government also has banned its insecticides. And as a result of this Supreme Court, actually Supreme Court passed an interim order. It is not a permanent order, interim order. They requested government to form a committee to evaluate the tragedy, to evaluate the effects and suggest. Till then, the production, sale, use is banned. And what the Central Insecticide Board and Registration Committee did, they issued this order to every companies and that this is banned. But they have, in their list, it is still not, endosulfan is still not banned. It is a star asterisk marked, and they have mentioned that as per order of the Supreme Court, this use, sale and etc. etc. is banned. So, but it is known that the government has made an affidavit to the Supreme Court that they may be allowed to use endosulfan in all states except Kerala and Karnataka, and these states are ready to, other states are ready to use this as a pest control, and they have agreed, government has agreed to phase out endosulfan within 2070. Why? Because there is already a huge stock of endosulfan. If it is not produced anymore, this total stock will go on up to 2070. And they have made the affidavit that if they destroy the endosulfan by incineration, it will cost a huge amount, almost about 200 crores. But if they are allowed to use those in the states which are which agree to allow, then it will cost less and also it will result in production. And they made it that 24 other countries are still using endosulfan, and Stockholm Convention has advised also the phasing out of endosulfan. So I do not know what is the intention of the government, but still it is in a, we are also in a dilemma. Whether Supreme Court passed an order, but the government also circulated this order, but still there is no mention that it is still banned, and it is also, there is no control. The government has withdrawn all the licenses given to different companies regarding the endosulfan, but it is one cannot be sure that endosulfan is not used in different parts of the country. Anyway, endosulfan, let us consider the endosulfan is gone, but what about the carbaryl? It is no less dangerous than the ecosystem. And what about the chlorpyrifos? Chlorpyrifos is apparently benign, less harmful, but is it safe for us? One study from Hyderabad National Institute of Nutrition, you see the different levels in tomato, eggplant, lettuce finger, cauliflower. The, this is the permissible limit, 0.2 microgram per kg, but how high is the concentration? This is really menacing report, but as per this is the paper which report this concentration, but there are many other reports which do not show such high concentration. At least one government report is that there is about 0.3%, only 0.3% of the different commodities, they contain the insecticide and pesticides at level higher than the permissible limit. And among them, the rice is high and vegetables are less, but only marginally higher. Several institutes, many from Maharashtra also are involved in it. Vidhan Chandra Kishi Vishwavidyalaya from West Bengal are involved. So several institutes together used this survey and they reported. Many people are reluctant to believe the government report, but I compared this report with two papers, one from the vegetables pest residue from Lucknow and another from the Delhi. And it is also similar to that of record, that in some of the vegetables it crossed the limit, acceptable limit, but marginally, as it is not so as high as which have been reported from the Hyderabad National Institute of Nutrition. But still, you see, you won't find this level in European market. So this cannot be allowed. Even if it is 3%, so, and if you continue to consume, because you see HIV, as mentioned in the earlier slides, the HIV require high amount of fertilizer, high amount of water, high amount of insecticides. So if HIVs are grown, so it may be that marginally some pesticides may be there in some vegetables and you may consume daily. So far as the chlorpyrifos is concerned, this in different river water, surface water also, but in very small concentration. This is one report, recent report you find, many small concentration, and compared to this level, in natural level of water, we carried out some experiments in laboratory, and in small organisms, it is called Daphnia, which is an invertebrate, is a fish food organisms, their susceptibility to chlorpyrifos, it is almost to that level. Not exactly, but almost to that level. But fish are rather safe. Tadpole, amphibian tadpole, they have a long, high tolerance. But again, in Kolaru fish lake, we have found a very high concentration chlorpyrifos. Not much report, but one report I have seen that this is a high concentration. Maybe that chlorpyrifos also have biomagnification property. Even if it is very present in very small concentration water, it may be biomagnified in the fish. If it is so, then it is dangerous. So finally, the last group of insecticide, pyrethroid, this is the most modern group of insecticide. And these pyrethroids are the derivatives of chrysanthemum flower. One active ingredient is called pyrethrins, and these pyrethrins, it is called environment friendly because this is photodegradable. Once you use, if it has a quick knockdown effect, and the insect will be killed, and soon after the insect is killed, the pesticide itself will be degraded because it is photodegradable. So that's why it is called environment friendly. And another important friendly aspect is that it is less toxic to birds and mammals, because in birds and mammals there is enzymes which can degrade this insecticide very quickly. And it has a specificity. It can specifically kill some insects, not others. So the active ingredients were synthesized in 1949 by one scientist. It's known as alethrin. But as it is, and from alethrin, several other synthetic products was developed later on. But still it is photodegradable, and as a result, it was not generally used in agricultural fields. It was used for indoor application, mosquito control, cockroach control. You see, you use Lakhan Rekha, it contains one of some pyrethroids. You use the cakes in the mosquito control, the vapor, it is some kind of pyrethroids. But it is quickly degraded. That's why it is not so much of harmful to man also. But people wanted to use it in the agricultural field also, and that's why it was necessary to make it photostable at least for some hours. So there was some development to modify the chemical structure, and this is one kind of, I am not going to detail about this molecular structure, but this is one kind of molecular modification was that alpha cyano group was introduced, and this type of pyrethroids are called type 2 pyrethroids, which contains alpha cyano groups. Many more modifications were made in the chemistry. Some organochlorine parts was introduced in some of the pyrethroids to make it specific. One is specific for one insect, another is specific for another insect. And these type 2 pyrethroids had effectiveness on the agricultural fields. Still they had some photodegradability, and they had least toxicity to birds and mammals. This is a review paper comparing the toxicity to birds and mammals and toxicity to fish and bears. As compared to mammals, the fish are highly toxic. Just to give you an idea how toxic, highly toxic means that just to live. So this is the small fish food organisms, earlier slide I have shown you, only from 0.03 microgram per liter, these are highly susceptible. The fish are moderately susceptible, amphibian tadpole are moderately susceptible, but the bottom organism, those who live in the bottom of the rivers or ponds, that means tuvifex worms live in the drains, then mollusks, they are highly tolerant. But in a very small concentration, it has been found they can cause a damage to the gills of the fish. apparently you cannot understand, but the fish can suffer the problems and ultimately there may be a reduced growth or total productivity, reduction in the productivity. But these are all experiments in the laboratory. There is no correlation of these experiments with that of the nature. What happens in the nature? So far as this pyrethroids are, the modern pyrethroids are concerned. So pyrethroids adhere strongly to the organic matter. That's why they very poorly they percolate into the underground water. So they are relatively immobile once they are adsorbed over the soil particles. So leaching through the groundwater is not a probability unless there are some degradation products which are known to percolate. There is a report from Bangladesh in which in the paddy fields and the river water it has been found at the level 0.06.1. It is very small level, and we have carried out some experiments in with the earthworm also, and earthworm it has been found that so far as one of the pyrethroids hypermethrin application in the agricultural field is concerned, earthworms are safe. And so far as this level is concerned, our laboratory experiment is concerned, only the fish food organisms may be considered as a most susceptible, otherwise other organisms are safe. But some areas of their toxicity of this modern pyrethroids to the non-target organisms still are in the gray. And this is not known, this environmental degradation products. Some of the authors, they have shown that some degradation products, they may form a dimer. And if they form dimer, they are no more non-persistent, they are persistent. They will stay like that of the DDT and other organochlorines for long, long period in the environment. But this area is really not known. This chemistry, their toxicity, there are a lot of things to do research on this. Another important aspect, this current trends, you see many pyrethroids which are very effective in the agricultural fields, they developed tolerance to insects. As a result, the farmers, with the suggestion of some scientists, they mix the organophosphates and the carbamates with that of the pyrethroids to make the pesticide effective. This is a dangerous trend. And in the some of the companies, they add synergist with that of the technical, or that means the pure insecticide, and to increase the efficiency, and this synergist inhibit the detoxification process in the organisms. Detoxification process in the mammalian and the birds, non-target organisms. And piperonyl butoxide is a common synergist that is added in many pyrethroids. So this type of trends are going on, although in pyrethroids which are modern, which are safe, which are considered as environment friendly, but still it cannot be considered safe so far as the non-target organisms are concerned. So finally, what is the solution? We have seen the residue level in the vegetables, we have seen the susceptibility of the organisms, we have seen susceptibility of the soil organisms, earthworms. Should we continue with more strict regulation and monitoring on insecticide use pattern? Really, this can be done. If we compare this monitoring and insecticide use pattern with that of the other advanced countries, we are really lagging behind. If we have a tough regulation, or say the agricultural people say good agricultural practices, then we could have less environmental problem. Or we can opt for the other option to protect the environment, save biodiversity, prevent health hazard. There is a movement, organic farming. This is a different story, different lecture. But organic farming means there is no use of fertilizers, chemical fertilizer, there is no use of insecticide, only the cultivation depending upon the natural processes. All over the world, this movement has started and have gained momentum. In India also already there are about 4 million hectares is all under this organic farming. The products from the organic farms have become very popular, though costly, but not keeping in pace with that of the natural production of HIVs. But there are certain restaurants all over the country also which only sell about the organically produced tea, organically produced meat, organically produced bread, etc. There are some leading states. Maharashtra is also one of the leading state of organic movement. I think so far my suggestion or my opinion is that we have to make a balance. Organic farming is still not possible to feed the whole country, but we have to keep our environment, we have to keep our health. So there should be a balance between the two. Thank you very much.
Let's thank Mr. Kovinaj for a very interesting talk, somewhat alarming, but he has given us a possible suggestion for solutions also, and he has also mentioned some student movement. I can see some students here, so perhaps they will be more aware of the bad effects on environment, so taking cue from the Kerala students, they can do something for the future generations. I can see some hands there. Yeah, please.
So, apart from pesticides, I mean, one thing we often read about is heavy metals.
Yeah.
Especially in Mumbai, where much of the vegetables are grown next to the railway tracks and irrigated with sewage sludge, etc. People worry about heavy metal uptake. Is that a serious problem?
More menacing. More dangerous. The problem is rather more dangerous, you see. Because you see in pesticides the natural I see residue level in some of the vegetables in at least about so far as the government report is concerned in 3% of the vegetables you find the pesticide residue level marginally increasing. But there is no government report on heavy metal residue, but personally I have done research for many years on heavy metal residues. It is a menacing level. If you carry out the residue on the fish and other aquatic organisms, but there is also a plus point, you see, for you, those who consume the fish. The fish face is rather safe so far as the heavy metal accumulation is concerned. Heavy metal is accumulated into the viscera, intestine, in other liver, kidney. These parts are not consumed generally by people. The muscle is the last target. Very least amount of heavy metals are accumulated in the muscle. But as a whole, if you take the whole fish, the heavy metal accumulation, because you see many of the factories, the byproduct effluent, the contents the heavy metals as a byproduct. Yeah, please.
From the plantation, what you showed, another village about 8 kilometers from there, we were much more affected. In our case, what we do is we send the cows and the calves, once they are more than 2 years old, to the hills for grazing. So initially, about early to mid-80s, all the cows died. We did not know why. Because at that time this endosulfur, which is sprayed with the helicopters
from
the cage to plantation.
Yeah, yeah.
So it will not be restricted there. It goes there.
Definitely.
Beyond there. So one calf, as an example, 3-year-old. Initially it could not walk. It will be wherever it is lying down. Mm. Once two people trying to lift it once or twice a day. So the
Yes, actually this tragedy was more severe only because this in Kasargod the endosulfan was used on aerial spray.
Yeah,
And the committee is set for this evaluation. They also told that this Kasargod episode cannot be compared with the other endosulfan episode because here it was an aerial spray. But you see, endosulfan is such a deadly insecticide. Nothing can be taken so easily.
The thing is, sir, from this experience, both what we showed here, where it is slightly not affected, but ours
but I have not shown this slide, but in many parts of the India the milk also contains endosulfan and other organochloride insects only because they eat the grasses from the affected areas.
Yes, so thing is that this is I am telling about 3 kilometers from the directly
Really tragic. Thank you.
There's this talk about using pheromones like methyl eugenol and other things for trapping the insects.
Yeah.
Some parts of Maharashtra, especially those people who are doing mango cultivation and other things, they use these traps to control the fruit flies. Has some similar things been done for a targeted species for other varieties as well, other insects as well? We know of one particular thing. What about the others?
Yes, these type of techniques are environment friendly. There are many other biological pesticides, neems, and also there are many other environment friendly pesticides. But actually, I have shown the maps on endosulfan. The farmers are so much addicted to endosulfan because of the low cost of the endosulfan and the ultimate the result they get. So, frankly speaking, these pheromones and this neem and many other biopesticides, so far as the bumper production of the HIVs is concerned, I started with the HIVs, they don't give the result. That's why there must be a balance between. Actually, we always campaign for the biopesticides, the environmental friendly like pheromones. So, so far as the total production, the need of the country, the farmers, what do the farmers want? So it cannot tally between the two. So there, it is a right time to make the farmers aware of the environment also to feed the people to the need of the country for the huge production that we need. So really, it is a very tough situation. So far as the environment, yes.
Shudip. What you said is really scary. So I wonder if there is data about accumulation in the human body, perhaps from cadavers, between India, which has such regulations and such low levels of regulation compared to maybe the US or the Europe.
I have shown one slide for the patients or the. This is so far the organochlorine pesticides are concerned. This is the organochlorine pesticide levels and risk of Parkinson disease in North Indian population. This similar type of data are also available. So just to show you that these neurological disease patients, they contain endosulfan, that you can correlate that these organochlorine residues can cause neurological. This is a it causes neurological disorders.
But much larger than what is typically found in the European.
Yes. Now that comparison, I don't have this data, but maybe, but it's actually this, initially I told you that use pattern is different. We use insecticide more than the other pesticides. Their use pattern is really different from us. So there is a, but this time I do not have this data to compare between the level that is found in man and the, and their restriction level, so far as the EPA in USA concerned and the other regulatory bodies in European countries are concerned, the label in the food that is required is different from the Indian standard institution. But so far as the international marketing is concerned, every country has to follow the Codex Alimentarius. It is a joint WHO and FAO regulations, the minimum permissible limit of the pollutants in each of the food committees. But some of the countries the level is higher, in some of the countries the level is lower, even in Germany, in USA. But so far as the international trade is concerned, they have to follow the Codex Alimentarius level. The permissible limit that I have shown here, it is the Codex Alimentarius level. Yeah.
Is there some body that monitors or controls?
Actually, insecticide regulating body, actually, they mention. This is the Central Insecticide Board and Registration Committee. They recommend a dose for each of the insecticide that they give license, or the different companies are registered for use. Accordingly, the company that manufactured this pesticide, they produce it this recommended dose in their level. This is in terms of active ingredients in per hectare. But the problem is that you see active ingredient, this is a pure form, a technical form. But when the pesticide comes into the market, it comes in different forms, sometimes in emulsified concentrate, 10% EC. You see, you find in insecticide, cypermethrin 10% EC. That means only 10% of the active ingredients are there. And rest of the things are a solution which sometimes contains synergized or some other emulsification. So they keep the active ingredients active and for effectiveness on use in agricultural fields. So this insecticide, Central Insecticide Board and Registration Committee, they regulate, they recommend the dose, according to the manufacturer keep this route, dose. But so far the non-target organism is concerned, these synergies, the toxicity of the synergies and other material that are added, it is not known. And the company never also divulge what they have mixed with these active ingredients also. That is a very big question. In fact, that in my last slide actually I wanted to highlight that, should we continue with the strict regulation? Actually, we don't have any regulation and monitoring. They recommend, thereafter it lies with the company, it lies with the manufacturer and the farmers. Hardly there is monitoring. I don't know personally that whether there is actually monitoring. If it was there, then the problem would have been less, I think.
In fact, I have a follow-up question, which is that in some cases this RED is not even safe, right?
No.
Some of your experiments found.
Yes. That's why I made the experiment on Artham in comparison to the RED. So that's why. Maybe it is in the laboratory this is high, but if you almost, it can be compared with the nature. So it is very difficult. So in the natural agro system, the ecology is really at peril.
Yeah. Okay. Yes,
is it necessary that this pesticide should be used more and more with subsequent time?
Pardon?
Is it necessary that this pesticide should be used more and more with every subsequent year?
No, actually it depends upon whether you want the more production with the pesticide. That is the question, very big question, you see. Once the HIV came into the market, earlier there was no need of so much of pesticide. My supervisor, PhD supervisor, used to tell me that you purchase only the infected vegetables from the market. Why? Because it means that infected vegetables do not have pesticides residue, apparently do not have pesticides. So that was the philosophy 10 years back.
Revolution, yeah. They are used extensively beyond the limit.
Beyond the limit.
And the case has become that the once such a rich state,
Now people are running to Rajasthan for treatment of cancer. Or cancer experts.
There is a cancer expert, right? You are right. Yeah.
Because of extensive use of this thing. Why people should use extensive use of this pesticide?
No, no. Actually, that's why I started with the Green Revolution. The ones the father of the Green Revolution got Nobel Prize in 1975, and also we have given Bharat Ratna to M.S. Swaminathan, who is the father of Green Revolution in India. Today we have a big question: is Green Revolution was welcome? Actually, you see, it started in Mexico, then from Mexico it went to Philippines, then to India, Bangladesh, etc. Otherwise, this Green Revolution could have not been successful. Today there is a question: we have done the right thing or not?
See, there is one tricky question there. If you look at in 1 acre of land, how much paddy we grow versus outside? Ours is very low, something like maybe less than 2 tons an acre, which is very, very low, and it can't give you any forget profit, even the cost. How exactly can you increase is the basic question. Maybe because we are using some not scientific or any method, we can probably do better by being more systematic. But the easiest method farmers think is that we may put more fertilizer, and maybe in many places where the moment monsoon meets, you have very many of these germs coming. So somehow you have to do it. The easiest method without any scientific clear study, what they do is put more fertilizer nowadays and put the insecticides. But I suppose a more systematic study somebody has to do rather than sitting in the laboratory
actually.
Okay, I think in view of the hour, let's continue our discussions over tea there.
Okay.
Very nice.
Thank you very much.
Very nice.